Welcome to Cookie Aloka on My Mind, where I, your host Jyotika, kick back and interview men about their experiences in the secret magic valley. So I am in Cookie Aloka with Sona, and Sona at the moment is on a reunion retreat for men who were ordained here 30 years ago in 1994, and Sona led that retreat. So he's kindly said he would be willing to be interviewed about Cookie Aloka and ordination and the spiritual life in general. So yes, you're very welcome, Sona. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's nice, lovely being here.
Yeah, great. The wind is picking up, which you'll hear in the background. Yeah, so I'm curious, when did you get ordained? You didn't get ordained in Cookie Aloka.
Well, it's 30-year anniversary this year for the people I ordained in 1994. And it's the 50th year anniversary of my ordination.
Wow.
So I was ordained with Malika, who's now deceased, and Vasantara, not people will know, and three other order members who have left the order or died in 1974 in a, I think it was a Sufi retreat center somewhere in West Sussex.
Very great. 50 years, wow. So jumping ahead to Cookie Aloka then, 30 years ago, was that the first ordination retreat you led?
Yeah, I'd been living in Sweden, setting up a center there for about 7 years. And I came back at the invitation of Subhuti and Banti to join a new ordination team that was being formed at Papaloka. So I joined that at the end of the 1980s. And 1992 was the first time I visited Cookie Aloka. I came with Subhuti on the 16-week ordination retreat. And the mandala huts had just been built. They hadn't quite been finished as well as they have been. Subhuti and I shared one. It rained an awful lot, I remember, on that retreat, and there was a kind of mud bath around the huts. Yeah, it was the first time I came here, and it was the first time I did ordination. So I did five private ordinations, and then 2 years later, I led a course here, the 16-week course, which was celebrating the moment there of the 17 men. And I ordained all the, publicly ordained all the guys, because there were so few public preceptors at the time. And then after that, I started coming sometimes every year to do an ordination. Suvajra and I swapped around. I would do 1 year, he would do the next year, leading the course. I was living at Papaloka and ended up developing retreats in Australia, New Zealand, the States. So it wasn't always easy to get away to Cookie Aloka, but I wasn't one of the few public preceptors. So I usually used to come and join the retreat for 4 to 6 weeks in the middle of the 4 months when the ordinations were taking place. So I would be there a week before the public ordinations or private ordinations, do some private ordinations and either lead alone or gradually there was people like Padmavajra and others coming in to be the public preceptors. So I was coming out most years, I think, for a few weeks in the middle. And quite often I would stay a bit longer than those other preceptors that sort of flew in and then went out, just participate in the retreat, meet up with people.
So 30 years ago then, so that was the first retreat you led and the first time you were a public preceptor?
Well, it wasn't the first retreat I led.
No, first ordination retreat. Yeah.
And the first time I was private precepting.
Private.
So Subhuti did all the other, I think he'd do all the other public ordinations, yeah. There were, maybe Suvajra was out here, I can't quite remember.
And how
there were a lot of people on that retreat, yeah.
And how was that for you in terms of the responsibility of it?
I think I've never really had a big problem with responsibility. As a young man, I was an engineer, I kind of was given a lot of responsibility to project manage projects. And so I was used to taking responsibility for other people. I suppose there's always this feeling that you're a bit of a fraud. You know, you think, well, who am I to ordain people? I suppose in some ways you become aware more and more of your faults. And obviously I had the blessing of Sangrakshita and Subhuti. I sometimes thought I was asked to be a preceptor just because we needed one. And I was the best choice because I was really the only choice. But actually, it turned out I kind of think I had a bit of a knack for witnessing men's going for refuge. Mm. So the responsibility side, I don't really remember it being that onerous. I was already taking quite a bit of responsibility at Papaloka again. But I do remember the effect of ordaining privately and then publicly, particularly maybe more privately, doing the ordination, actually both of them. There's something happens that it, in my experience, is a bit like it's not you doing it. It's a bit like, I can't say it felt like, if I said I felt like I was being taken over by some external force, that wouldn't be right. But it was a, and if I said there was something working through me, that might sort of sound all a bit wooey or something. But there was something spiritual about it. And it was the meeting in the private ordination with the person I was going to ordain, going through a very simple ceremony in. But it's ritualized, and so the whole ritual was having an effect on both of us. And it just was such a wonderful feeling. It was a bit like I was out of the way, my normal worrying of, am I doing this right, and so on. It was called out of the way, and something else took over. Doing the public ordinations were a little bit more anxiety-ridden, because I had to give a little talk and read things in the right place, and I was probably more anxious, not worried about the responsibility, just anxious I was going to get the words right, going to recite all the precepts. But again, it was I had this idea that you needed, copying Sangharakshara, I thought, and Subhuti, you needed a sort of a combination of lightness and being, you know, with joy, feeling joy for the occasion, and at the same time bringing a certain gravitas into the ceremony, which I seem to pick up from people's feedbacks. You know, it seemed to happen quite well for me, and so I really enjoyed the actual ceremony once it started. It's probably a bit like actors feel before you go on stage. You get anxious and so on. But once you're into the role, as it were, something happens and you just become it. It was a privilege, always a privilege to ordain people.
You say that you had a knack for witnessing men's going for refuge. Could you say a bit more about that?
Well, maybe not. That sounds a bit simple in a way. I think actually one of my responsibilities, and this wasn't so much the responsibility of the ceremony, but was the responsibility of a ordination team member. So someone who was training men in how to function as an order member and so on, or how to make the best out of being an order member. Knowing when someone was ready to join the order has always been a bit of a mysterious thing. You have these guidelines, which if not careful, they become like hurdles and hoops that people just go through and jump over. But underneath it all, there's probably something to do with more of some sort of intuition. Maybe even intuition isn't right. It's as though there's only thing I can think of is a bit like two guitar strings. You pluck one and the other one starts vibrating in harmony with the first one. I've never done that, but apparently that's what happens. And I used to feel like that when I was spending time with Mitras, studying with them, talking to them, well, sometimes working together, doing things together. You get a feeling that this person kind of was, whatever I meant by going for refuge, they were doing the same thing as me in a sort of harmonious way, like these, you know, the sort of waves of a sine waves of like sound are in harmony and two going along together. So I thought I could rely quite a lot on my own judgment, and it was backed up by comments and views and so on. From lots of other people, of course, but I usually ended up feeling I could ordain this person because I put in a sort of the parlance we used. I could witness their going for refuge. They were going for refuge in the same way that I was, and I was going in the same way that Saint Grachta was and his teachers and so on back. That's how it was presented, and in a way, that's how I felt. And I when I say I had a knack for it, I think it was more like I felt confident, rather than a knack. I just felt having a knack is the wrong word, but being confident that this is what's happening. And of course, you can. It's not that you're necessarily wrong at the ordination, but you know, I've had a number of people resign and leave the order afterwards. But at the time, at that moment, and leading up to that moment, and even after that moment, I was very confident that this person was living out their spiritual life in the same way that I was, even though our lifestyles would be very different often.
Okay.
And when you went through that ritual with these men, did the relationship change significantly? And if so, how?
Interesting question there. I think in at the time of the ordination, maybe even leading up to it, you can feel you're getting to know someone better. There were a few people I ordained I didn't get to have time really to get to know, because I was required to ordain a lot of people in a very short period of time.
This is as a public preceptor?
As a public preceptor, although I ordained over 40 to 50 people privately as well. So I think what I felt was, I mean, when you do the ceremony, of course, it's a big thing, it's a big ritual, and you feel something's happened. But then after it, just everything normalizes again. And I just noticed over the years of how whatever happened in that ritual meant something in my relationship, my connection with all the people I've ordained. So when I meet someone, and nowadays, quite honestly, I can't always remember whether I ordained someone publicly. I can always remember the private ones, but publicly. But I might ask someone, and I have this feeling, I'm really connected with you. I kind of know the answer. But I could connect with people very strongly just because I've been spending a lot of time with them in study groups in the years preceding their ordination. So we might have had a very strong connection anyway. But the ritual and the actual ordination is special. And it's a bit like I never thought of it in this way, but it's a bit like I'd laid down my life for these people, you know. So it's something really strong. It's very powerful. And I've always felt open to one of my failings really as a human being, you could say, and as a preceptor, is that I'm not always proactive. So even if I sometimes know someone needs a bit of help, I might not always be first to go and give it. But usually if someone wants, I'm asked to help, or someone asks me to do something, or someone comes to me and say, can I talk to you? I've always made myself available and done my duty. But my duty wasn't like an onerous duty. It was something I wanted to do, enjoyed doing it, even though sometimes it was painful, what we had to talk about. It's difficult to explain really.
It's a mysterious area.
And it is a privilege, actually. And you do feel something spiritual is happening. And I mean, at Guhyaloka, if I could say something about that, because this was, my ordinations took place with Subhuti leading, and it was very much a Subhuti course. And then I just just followed the same programs and things and rituals that he and Suvadra together had sort of brought into being. So there was something about being here and the fact that we actually made it sort of spiritual somehow. Now, I've always had a feeling that in nature there's some weird unnameable something that is very, very positive, and it's being alive is being alive to nature. And being here, we kind of made it being alive to the spiritual. So it's a bit like not just the ordinary nature, but something of a higher order. And, it's like, could be imagination or whatever, but it's like bringing something into life that wasn't obvious beforehand. And the ordinations were just all part of that. They were pivotal because the 16-week retreats started leading up to the ordination. It took place in the middle, and then there was a sort of training afterwards. And so gradually you couldn't help feeling the whole place was being imbued, or something's being evoked that sort of is around you in the trees and the rocks and the buildings and everything. And coming back here today, I don't think I've been back for 20 years. I mean, it's changed in as much, a lot of the trees are much bigger than the, and in some ways they're blocking some of the views, but so it feels different. But when I look at the buildings and just walk around the place, I can still begin to feel again this strange, I like to call it a spiritual quality. I mean, being mean by that, of something of a higher order than the normal.
So you say you, like in the 16-week course, you began to imbue the valley with, I guess, a spiritual significance of the activities you were doing. And do you feel it was a two-way thing? It's kind of vague terrain, but yet...
Yeah, I definitely... I mean, you can look at these things in all different ways. You could look at it on a sort of psychological level and just say, well, it's just me and my mind making this into a spiritual place. Or you could be a bit more imaginative and allow another part of your being realize, well, actually, there are sort of forces at work all around me. There's just like life growing everywhere and lots of things happening and that I'm tuning in with. So the two things kind of coalesce and they... One works on the other. Now, to be clear about it and make it definite is impossible. It's just that it's like often a vague feeling, or also a kind of knowing as well. It's not like a vague feeling, well, I'm not sure of it. It's more like a vague feeling, which I'm really sure of. But okay, to describe it and say what's actually happening, that's the vague bit of it. And but something, even saying something, because it's a process that's happening all the time, is you can pick up on it and participate in it. It's as though you're, it's not like entering the stream of enlightenment necessarily, but you're entering into a sort of a stream of something and partaking of it and being affected by it. And so the way you think about things is being affected by it, which probably in turn, feeds back on itself. And you're doing this with a lot of people, and it's even when you're not here, you know it's going on with a lot more people. So like something like 35, getting for 40 years of practice here, coming when it first retreated was now. But there's been a lot of practice of people not just meditating. I mean, meditation is probably the smallest thing they've done actually, because they do that several hours a day, but the rest of the time talking, walking, thinking, being, working with their, reactivity or whatever, to other people that you get on retreats when someone doesn't do the washing up right or something. All those things you practice, and that's a lot of it going on. And just being here with the other six guys that I ordained, you can just see we just slotted straight back into that. And it's just as though we've been here the whole time, even though we've been looking back over the last 30 years to see how each of us sort of lived out our spiritual lives in our lives, which include the spiritual.
When I was very interested when you were talking about, life is going on all around us here and you tune into it, and you could see it psychologically, kind of projection, or you'd be more imaginative. I'm curious about that, the imaginative interaction, and the way you talk about it. It is like, for you, the valley here in Gukyaloka, it's been something in and of itself inherently spiritual.
Yeah. Well,
is that a fair way to
You could say that. Maybe if I could just give you a quick little bit of history. I mean, I was brought up in London, lived in London. I was born close to the London Buddhist Centre, actually, in North London, till I was 22 or something, and then I moved to Cambridge and Norfolk. And then in the 1980s, I moved to Sweden. And when I was in Sweden, which is a land covered in forest, and I got to, you know, I got quite close to Swedes, and I learned their language. And I was fascinated by the fact that the Swedes talked about going out into nature. They didn't say going out into the countryside. They said they had to go into nature. And the way they say it in Swedish, it sounds to me different to the way I say it in English. And I've realized they were experiencing something that I wasn't experiencing. And I think that would just be sentimental, you know, just nature's, you know, forces of nature. Of course, there's forces of nature around. I don't really know what they were taking. But then I had to gradually accept there was something that they were really that going on for them that I just wasn't sensitive enough to. One day I was in Finland at the time. I'd gone to Finland to lead a retreat or something. And I had this moment of realization, the forest where I was just outside of Helsinki, just extended right the way around the world, you know, almost unbroken, right the way through what it was, the USSR, Russia, through Siberia, Canada. And it freaked me out. It was a bit like I felt something of a much bigger order. Mm. And then when I went back to Sweden, my whole attitude to the lakes, the rock, stone everywhere, and even though I lived in Stockholm, it was only a half an hour's trip out into the wilds of the forest or by lakes and things. And I just realized I was starting to tune into something different. Right. So when I came here, it was sort of the same. I had the same sort of feeling. In some ways, this is even more primitive. There's a lot more spectacular here. In a way, Sweden isn't spectacular in that way, because it's got the mainly forest and then lakes in the middle of it. And at first, when I came here, I was just overawed by the beauty. So I used to walk up the valley and I just go, wow, wow. After a few days, I had to stop looking at things because I just couldn't take more in. It was just like blown me away, as it were. And but then gradually you just could look down at the small bits of rock and the, you know, bushes and different things, and everything seemed to be alive. And then suddenly you realize there were insects everywhere doing business, ants growing. There was often geckos on the walls, not so many birds, but occasionally every now and again there would be eagles flying over, the wind and and the, you know, the sky sometimes changed, the mist come up. Everything was so different to what people would really can experience in an urban situation, a big city. So being out here, it's not that difficult, I think, to tune in. And even if you don't know you're tuning in, you are tuning in. That's just my theory. It affects people being here. And they might just say, it's because it's so beautiful, it's so quiet. Yeah. The sort of psychological things which you can easily accept, but the sort of more wooey-wooey things that you think, well, I don't know about that, but, you know, it's everything we sort of do is mysterious, really. Even being alive is a mystery. So
the wooey-wooey stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
I'm interested in. why is that? Why would you say that is important for our spiritual lives?
Well, I think if you Sanger, actually, he talked at some point about having like three levels of consciousness, the psychological, the spiritual, the transcendental. So the spiritual is that level of consciousness that you can access through meditation, so directly in the dhyanas and so on. The transcendental, you can't make that happen. It's all something over and above, of course. But what we're used to, because we live in such a material world, is the psychological. So we, you know, less things can be proved scientifically, as being real and happening in a certain sort of way, then they become a bit wooey-wooey, you know. So, and particularly when someone says, that's what I think, this is happening. But, you know, I kind of like to think of myself as agnostic to most things. I just don't know it. Like, life is such a mystery. Death is such a mystery. I mean, how can life have ever come into being? You know, because it must have come into being outside of time and space. I'm not all whammy. So I just feel, what a limit, what a sort of a poverty one lives in if you just live with the psychological, the material, and you just talk in terms of things as being, oh, lovely or beautiful. And even if you use the word beauty, you start using your rational mind to ask yourself, what is beauty? You can't really say. You know, obviously people have written no end of degrees on this and doctorates and things on beauty. But at the end of the day, beauty is something you experience. And when you start trying to pin it down, we all have slightly different ways of looking at it. Yeah. So if you allow your mind to sort of recognize that, well, beauty is this accessing something of a higher order, you kind of think, oh, that's, I can go with that. Yeah. That's not really wooey-wooey. Or if wooey-wooey's, usually that's used as a derogatory term, but I just like to turn it around and say wooey-wooey is great.
Yeah. Should get a
Why
t-shirt?
Not make it into a positive term, you know? But every time anyone uses it, you go, yeah, that's right, it's wooey-wooey. And your mind's opening up. It's coming, your consciousness is expanding. You're getting more freedom and you're not sort of bound down by the oppressions of worldly life and life and death. You know, it's all expanding, and I think it's what hopefully all our retreats do, centers give. And what's so special about Gukhyalocha, of course, is that people have been training to come here for a long time. So in some cases 10 or 15 years I've known people train, they come here and they've got all that, there's a lot of expectation, there's a lot of opening up already. And then there's the whole myth of Gukhyalocha, which is, you could say, well, that's on the psychological level. But then when you're here and you're meditating, you're practicing a lot of silence and really open communication with one another, something else is sort of coming into being, which everyone, I think almost everyone you talk to will know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And and I'm sure it's the same at the Women's Ordination Retreat Center as well.
Yeah.
Spain.
Yeah.
And you know, in other this happens on a much smaller scale in all our retreat centers, but it's just the retreats aren't usually so long.
Yeah.
And we've had up until Brexit, we had the privilege of having 16 week retreats here. And if you interview some of the other people here, this morning we were talking about, two of them have said it was the first time it's the only time in their whole life, and they're in their 60s now, that they've experienced it, it's the longest period of time they've experienced complete contentment. 16 weeks of contentment. It's quite a thing. And even if it's cut down to 12 weeks, which seems to be the case today, what a gift to give people. You to know that your life can be that content if you only have the right conditions. Much of the spiritual life, as far as I'm concerned, is all about providing the right conditions. The rest seems to take care of itself.
Great. Okay, I could go on, but I'm just aware of time.
Nice to end it.
And it's a nice place to end it. Yeah. So, Sona, thank you very much. Here we are in the valley, in the midst of the wooey wooey.
So it's not really wooey wooey.
Great. All right. Thank you for listening to Gukhyalocha on My Mind. If you'd like to find out more about the Gukhyalocha fundraising project, please visit the Gukhyalocha for the Ages page on our website, gukhyalocha.org. Take care.